Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2024. I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for Judge Phil Fafababa from the city of Calabasas, South Carolina. I don't know what that was.
I don't either, but I liked it. With us today is Katie Rich to talk about My Cousin Vinny. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Hi, guys. You want me to bust out my Southern accent or should I save that for later? I mean,
you can do whatever you want.
I know you live in the South now. Did you grow up there?
I live in North Carolina now. I grew up in South Carolina. So, Emily, every time you talk about South Dakota, I feel like there is some kind of kinship there of growing up in backwaters with South in the name where everyone's like, how did you learn about culture from where you grew up? It's like, well, we had to try hard to figure it out, but we got there somehow.
So do you have like a kinship with Stephen Colbert? I feel like he grew up.
Oh, yeah. South Carolina. He's from South Carolina. Aziz Ansari's from South Carolina. Daniel Brooks, recent Oscar nominee for The Color Purple. I have like the list of famous people who grew up in South Carolina is pretty short. Emily, I wonder if you're in the same boat on South Dakota. Like, you know your people.
The list is even shorter. It's Bob Barker, who's dead, and January Jones. Like, that's it. And actually,
it's interesting.
South Dakota is so small that I once went to a party of like theater kids in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and January Jones was there. I never met her, but like we were kind of like, she was older than me, but we were like, we overlapped just enough.
Yeah,
she was at this party and then she went off and became January Jones, and now she has a wonderful Instagram
presence. She really does. That's what we all aspire to, really, is to escape our hometowns and get good Instagrams.
So since you both grew up in the quote-unquote South, Katie, more so than Emily.
Yeah, I was able to definitely did it, but yes, I get the spiritual connection.
I grew up in the South Canada, basically. You know?
That's right. Do you feel like, this is obviously more towards you, Katie, that Alabama has similarities? I mean, I think Alabama's more deep red, right? I mean,
Alabama's similar to where I grew up.
Yes, to where you grew up.
Yeah. I mean, South Carolina is pretty red, like a state. I mean, I think Alabama and Mississippi are kind of the states that you look at when you're in the South, being like, well, we're not them. Like, South Carolina, I feel like when I was growing up, had like the 47th worst schools in the country, and like they were below us. So we definitely had that. I mean, My Cousin Vinny was filmed in Georgia, like not super far from where I grew up. So visually it looks very, very familiar.
Interesting.
But yes, I think like this and Forrest Gump, and there's probably another example of like, you know, hardcore Alabama South from this period where we were like, well, you know, we're not them. We're cultured.
I do feel like when Hollywood's going to make a movie about the South, what they mean is Alabama or Mississippi.
Yes.
It's like Tennessee, Louisiana, the Texas. Carolinas, Florida. They all have their like own
they have their different
cultures.
Things. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, but when we say the South, we mean Mississippi and Alabama.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I mean, I think that this movie gets a lot of mileage out of fish out of water, what it's like in the South versus anywhere else in the world, it seems, to some degree. Had you seen this film? I mean, I'm assuming you'd seen this one before, Katie, but when did you see this film for the first time? Do you remember?
So it took me a while, actually. So I need to shout out my friend Dana Woolman, who grew up in Brooklyn. And when I met her in college, went to college in Connecticut and met her, and she was like, "Oh my God, you're from South Carolina. Have you seen My Cousin Vinny?" I was like, "No, it just wasn't on the list." I mean, it's, you know, it's an R-rated movie. It came out when I was enough of a kid that it wouldn't have been like the top priority, but her family loved it, even though she wants to make it clear they're more like Bernie Sanders Brooklynites than, you know, Vincent Gambini Brooklynites. And so, like, when she would come with me on like spring break trips to the South, I think she was basically bracing for everyone in the diner to look at her the way that they would look at Mona Lisa Vito. So I think I saw it for the first time in college, kind of like Fried Green Tomatoes, I didn't see for that long. Prince of Tides, I didn't see for that long. Those, there's a lot of early 90s South movies that the Oscars paid attention to in an interesting way. And it took me a while to catch up on those. Really, Forrest Gump, I think, is my...
As well?
Steel Magnolias. That one, that one I had seen earlier. But I feel like Forrest Gump was when I was like, oh, there's movies about the South. It's not like we're just in some cultural backwater nobody pays attention to, which, you know, obviously is a couple of years after this.
Sure. Forrest Gump, you know, realism being at the top of the list of things that Forrest Gump is
filmed. A lot of it filmed in South Carolina, though. So we were very excited about that.
For a long time, Forrest Gump was the only thing I would admit I had cried at, like, period, including like my grandparents' funerals. I was like, yes, I didn't cry there, but I did cry at Forrest Gump. And like,
which part got you?
I think when his mom died, I don't remember precisely, but it was like, it was something to do with Sally Field. I also remember walking out of that movie and being like, Oscars all around.
Well,
you were right. Yeah.
But I was incensed that Sally Field didn't get nominated. She should have been nominated. She's so good.
She should have been nominated. Yeah, she is very good. The scene that gets me to this day still is him at Jenny's grave at the end. Just kidding.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. She wants to be a bird and fly far, far away.
I had just enough. I was obviously not out to myself as a girl yet, but I had just enough girl in me to be like, I don't think Jenny should be with him.
Not a great fit. But, yeah. So, Emily, you had seen My Cousin Vinny, right? Or is
this is my first time I've ever seen it. I really was not expecting it to be set in the South. I was like, this is going to be a movie about like a wise. It's going to be like Better Call Saul, set in Brooklyn. It's going to be about like a guy who like is an ambulance chasing lawyer, and his girlfriend helps him solve cases. And he has to like, I had no idea who Ralph Macchio was in this. B, I didn't know which of those two guys at the start was Ralph Macchio, which caused my wife to pause the film and go, what are you talking about? And I said, I've never seen a single Karate Kid. And she said, do you want to watch the Karate Kid? And I said, I can't because I have to podcast about this. Anyway.
Good movie.
So Karate Kid is next.
Never seen it.
Good movie.
I've never seen any of them. Yeah.
So, I mean, it is interesting because I feel like we've all seen this movie at different times in our lives. I saw this film, I mean, I don't think I was in college, but I think I was probably in high school, mid-90s, probably mid to late 90s. And not kind of, I mean, I liked it fine, but I don't think that it really registered for me as a teenager of something that like, it just didn't click for me.
We hadn't lost comedies like this entirely by then. 100%. And now it feels different, I think.
This movie also got reclamated, it seems, in the last less than 5-7 years, where like Mona Lisa Vito became like a mascot of the internet in a lot of ways.
I read Ebert's review. He gave it 2.5 stars and he was like, I think a lot of this doesn't work. But like, and he was like, the last 45 minutes are like one of the best movies of the year. And I was like, watching it and kind of like just not really vibing. And then the last 45, when he goes to trial, it just suddenly like, that feels like, it feels like they reverse engineered from a really good TV pilot, which like, that's obviously is not the case.
Yeah.
But the last 45 minutes are like exactly the shape and length of a TV episode. And then they're like, we got to build up to it.
You know? True. Yeah. I mean, we were texting a little bit about this, Emily, and I don't disagree that like, it's probably too long for its own good. I mean, it doesn't need to be 2 hours. I think it could be closer to
like 90 minutes would be a perfect runtime for this.
Yeah. I think that it's the buildup, if you will, to the trial. It's just got a lot of air in it, I think, that, but, you know.
And a friend of mine is a lawyer, and he was like, this is a very accurate movie about being a lawyer, and in the same way that Better Call Saul is accurate about being a lawyer on television. And he's like, there's a lot of downtime. You have to deal with judges, et cetera, et cetera. But like, I think in the space of a bright studio comedy from the 90s, you feel that flab in a way you might not now. Although that said, my wife was really against this movie for most of its running time. And she was particularly like annoyed by some of the running gags. And then you get to the end and he's like falling asleep in the jail cell because there's all the noise. And she's like, she laughed and she was like, he can sleep because it sounds like New York. So you do kind of need the, like, the buildup does help some of the gags in the last 45 minutes, but it definitely is, it's kind of flabby up until.
Yeah.
Sorry, please go ahead.
Well, there's like the bits, like the guy in the pool hall who they owe the $200 to, that like don't really lead to anything, but like the sleeping one kind of pays off. Obviously the grits thing pays off later on. Like there are things that, or, you know, then there's the, their argument about the faucet, which like sets you up for the very end. Like you can see some of it really tightly leading to the end. And then a lot of it's like, what else would happen if they were in a small town? And it's weird that they can't choose between them.
Well, it's, I mean, yeah, it I don't know how much I love all the judge stuff, quite honestly, like the whole identity, is he, you know what I mean? Like that stuff doesn't, I mean, it sort of pays off because Mona Lisa helps him at the end get out of that. But it's just, they go back to the well too many times. You could still get the payoff without going to it four or five times.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the judge should just say, are you licensed to practice law in the state of Alabama?
And we're done. Yeah, I just...
I definitely thought you can't just do that. Like show up from out of state. And I my dad's a lawyer. I should know these things. But I did feel like you should just be able to do that.
Well, this movie is very legally accurate. So Jonathan Lynn, the director, actually has a law degree from the University of Cambridge. In a 2019 decision, Merrick Garland, then the judge of the United States Courts of Appeal, wrote that in 1992, Vincent Gambini taught a masterclass in cross-examination and further extensively quoted the cross-examination scene. This movie, there's many, many other examples of this movie being referred to in legal circles as just sort of the basics that are, like, lawyers should watch this movie if they want to know how to actually, like, cross-examine people. It's insane.
I was fascinated. There's like papers that were like, this is a better example of legal jurisprudence than A Few Good Men. And I was like, okay.
Which I believe 100%. I don't think Sorkin did a lick of research. He just liked the way things sounded. But I do think that this movie has sort of, the esteem towards it has only grown. And I think it's because of what you said, Katie, which is that there's just not movies really like this anymore.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we want to talk about the Oscar thing later, but I feel like Marissa Tomei's win was so picked upon. And I think later on, people are like, hang on a second, everybody. Stop being such assholes about it.
100%.
Reclaiming her career specifically.
I do feel like, Marissa Tomei has had such a resurgence. I mean, she's always like, it feels like she has a resurgence every 5 years. It feels like she's just always around, and like people forget about her. And then they're like, oh, wait, she's in this and she's great.
She's so good.
But it does feel to me like the timing works out where this kind of came back on the radar after the Moonlight La La Land thing. Where suddenly everyone was like, oh, Marissa Tomei actually won. They did have a process, a terrible process that didn't work at all in place for the wrong thing won. So like Marissa Tomei must have won. Let's go see what that's all about. Like that's kind of what happened.
Plus, I got to say, too, I rewatched her Oscar win. It is clear that Jack Palance is reading from the card. So there were a lot of people that said that he read the teleprompter incorrectly, or that, and admittedly, he was very old, spoiler, and did seem a little confused up there, if I'm being completely honest.
This is a grand tradition of Oscar presenters, is to show up and nobody quite knows what they're going to say when they open that envelope.
Al Pacino this year, for instance.
Yeah.
Was.
By the time this airs, I guess it'll be less of a fresh topic, but yes.
But I do want to give just a little bit of context to our listeners who might not have seen this film. The synopsis is, New York lawyer Vinny has never won a case. When his teenage cousin Bill and his friend Stan are accused of murder in a backwater Alabama town, it's up to nervous Vinny to save him from jail, even though he's only ever tried personal injury cases before, and none of them successfully. My Cousin Vinny opened on March 13th, 1992, against Wayne's World, The Lawnmower Man, Fried Green Tomatoes, and Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Stop. or my mom will shoot. Yeah. It will go on to make $64 million on an $11 million budget. It has 87% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 87% from audiences. It is interesting. This is also an example, and we've talked about this, Emily, on previous episodes as well, but this was a big rental movie, right? Like, this movie did incredibly well on VHS and DVD, which is part of, and cable television. Like, that's part of why it was a staple, I think, is why it did so well. Emily, you mentioned, sorry, go ahead.
We talked before we were recording about sort of the movie theater experience versus the at-home experience. And like, mm-hmm. I love going to the theater, but like in 1993, if you rent My Cousin Vinny and watch it on your TV at home, I don't know that the experience is that different. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in a theater, people are laughing a lot, but like the filmmaking is kind of anonymous. It's a very good movie, but I think it plays amazingly at home.
It's something if you're watching in a room full of your family and you've seen it like three or four times, like my friend Dana tell me about her family bringing it back over and over again. Like, it's comfort watch. It's R rated, I guess, because of language. So it's not like a full family movie, but it makes sense as something that kind of like lives in your house along with you as opposed to like a theatrical experience.
I do think though, and yes, Emily, before we got on mic, we were talking about the movie going experience. And I do think that perhaps the genre that's been hit the hardest by this is comedies, because people don't think they need to see comedies on the big screen. I would argue being in a theater filled with people laughing is only going to make that movie experience better. Take it for what it's worth.
I went and saw Anyone But You, and that theater was full and nobody was laughing. But
is it funny? I still haven't seen that one.
There's some good gags in it. It's No Hard Feelings, which has huge third act problems, but was like a much better, much funnier movie.
They don't know how to end that movie, unfortunately. Yeah. There's kind of no way to end it. But I did see both of them in the theater, and I would agree with you, Emily. No Hard Feelings plays a lot better in a theater than Anyone But You. Emily, you mentioned Ebert gave this 2.5 stars. He said, My Cousin Vinny is a movie that meanders along, going nowhere in particular, and then lightning strikes. I didn't get much involved in it, and yet individual moments and some of the performances are very funny. It's the kind of movie home video was invented for, not the trip to the theater, but slam it into the VCR and you'll get your rentals worth. So there you go, Emily.
Wow.
Ebert from the grave agreeing
what
with you.
1992 neg. Jeez.
Right. I do think, as I mentioned, there's ways to tighten the first half of this movie to get us to the trial faster. But that being said, Joe Pesci and Marissa Tomei, I basically watch them do anything. Like, their characters are so funny and lived in and silly, and seeing the whole fish out of water stuff works really well. Them at the diner where the menu just says breakfast, lunch, and dinner. there's just stuff about it that just, it's perennial. It just works. It's evergreen.
Several of my friends' Letterboxd reviews said something along the lines of like, how did they not try to do like a Columbo series based on these two and send them everywhere? Like, it is probably better that they didn't do that. I don't think they would have been pay limitations, but like, it ends with them driving off into the unknown future, you know, it's almost like setting up for that.
I think Justine Triet should direct a My Cousin Vinny sequel set in the French court system, where Vinny and Mona Lisa have to like deal with French court because they can just practice law there for some reason. Great.
I mean, there was a sequel that they talked about at one point where he was going to go to England. Vinny was going to go to England. And
great.
Marissa Tomei had no interest, understandably, and was just like, I want an Oscar for this. I'm not going to England.
Yeah.
But again, I could see it. I could see you putting Vinny in different situations, right? Like, you could do that. They made a book series, apparently. There was a series of books that they did about it.
Really?
I do think one of the problems is like a movie like this hits, and they got Pesci and Tomei were not their first choices for those roles. They probably didn't pay them what they were worth. And the second it's a hit and one of them wins an Oscar for it, suddenly it's like, oh, we would have to pay up. And at that point, I don't know that like My Cousin Vinny sequel becomes profitable, but I would have watched it.
I would have watched it too. I mean, you spoke of the people that they went to, Emily. Andrew Dice Clay was the first choice for the studio to play
naturally.
Vinny. Naturally, everyone's first choice.
Was he at his peak at that point? Like, that's... Yeah. Okay.
It's, I mean, peak. It's in quotation marks. I mean, I feel like there was a very brief moment when before Fort Fairlane comes out where everyone's like, we're ready for Andrew Dice Clay to take over the world. They also went to DeVito, Peter Falk, Robert De Niro, Jim Belushi, who notoriously hates himself for having turned it down. But like, the movie's not going to be
it wouldn't have been any good.
Right? Mm-hmm. So like, what do we... they go to Pesci, who had just finished Lethal Weapon 2 and had finished working on Goodfellas, literally brings his Oscar to the set of My Cousin Vinny so people can see it. Not to be a dick, but just because I'm assuming he wanted people to see it. And then Lorraine Bracco was the first choice for Mona Lisa. Again, I get it, but I don't know. Like, I'm currently listening to the Medicine Man episode of Blank Check. So, like, Lorraine Bracco had
is on the brain,
but also just a bumpy post Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. So, like, you do have to ask yourself whether or not this had probably been a better choice for her. But Debbie Mazur was also auditioned for the role, which I can see. It makes sense. And then
because Marissa Tomei was really nobody before this, right?
Literally, he discovers her, and by he I mean Jonathan Lynn. He went to the set of the movie Oscar, everyone's favorite comedy, and right. John Landis introduced him to Marissa Tomei, who had like a minor part in that movie, and that's how she gets the role.
I genuinely watching the first half of this movie was like, she's very good, but I don't understand why people love this performance so much.
Yeah,
because she's very vibrant, and I could see it in terms of like, this is her big breakthrough role. And then of course the last 30 minutes is just like a powerhouse for her, and it's the end of the movie, so that's what you remember walking out. Mm-hmm. But I was surprised like how little she was in the first half. She's there, but she's not like the main supporting character.
And she has no plot function whatsoever. No. She's kind of there. I mean, I do think once you know what's coming, you kind of see the beginning when she says, like, I bet the Chinese food is terrible. And you're like, okay, all right. She's fucking, she's coming in hot from the very beginning. But you're right that there's no, you don't really get why she's there until all of a sudden you do.
The main relationships are him with his cousin and him with the judge. And that's like what the movie hinges on. And also, are they going to fire him as their lawyer? It's like, it's a lot of it is just like, you know, the movie's heading in a certain direction. So the first half, when it tries to delay where it's going, you feel that a bit more than I think you would in a movie that was a bit more elegant about that, because you know he's going to defend both of them, and you know he's going to get one over on the judge. And it feels like, I feel like they hit every beat in those stories one time too many, and that's probably why.
100%. Yeah.
They're trying water too. I mean,
The kind of misunderstanding, like you're talking about two different things. They do it when the guys get brought in to be questioned about the crime, you know, the I shot the clerk part. And then they do it again when Vinny shows up and it's a bunch of prison rape jokes, which we can talk about whether or not those are welcome reminders of the past.
Just pull those right out of there.
Yep. You really could, because it's repeating the exact same structure again. And like the last 45 minutes are so clever in terms of playing with what you know and what the people in the courtroom know, that it's weird that stuff is in there kind of so clunky at the beginning.
I will say, when Macchio says, "My cousin Vinny," it's like one of the great title drops of all time.
100%.
Yeah, I wrote it down. It's 12 minutes in. He says, "My cousin Vinny." And you're like, great, here we go.
Then, like, smash cut to the car driving into town with the music. Yeah. And the, like, it's a perfect entrance. Mm-hmm. But I think we spend too much time with Macchio and his friend. I mean, just by and large, I understand that they want the stakes of their situation, but it does feel as though we're with them, to your point, Emily, for too much of the first chunk of the movie. That I just sort of, it should also be said too, which is insane, that Ben Stiller and Will Smith independently auditioned for these roles, which I think is just crazy. I don't know what that even looks like, but it is just interesting how, structurally speaking, it is kind of screenplay writing 101, but because it adheres so sort of strictly to it, it feels like we just, I don't even know that we're jaded, but we just know it too well now. Mm-hmm. The problem.
It would be so 90s if Will Smith said, "My cousin Vinny," and then you cut to Joe Pesci. Like, that's the sort of thing they were doing in the 90s. It would have been great.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, I mean,
the screenwriting thing I was thinking of that you guys might know more about is, you know, the way you set up a murder mystery where they don't, you know, they show the guys at the convenience store. We know they didn't do it, but we don't ever see the other car. We don't ever see the other witnesses. And so we have no sense of the crime as it actually took place. And then you don't also see Vince, you see Vincent doing the interviews with the witnesses, but you don't see him being like, oh, well, actually, like, how far away is the woman's house from the thing? And I wondered what you guys think, if it's better for us not to know where he's headed when he talks to the guy about cooking grits, or if maybe they could have gotten more mileage out of showing some of that process more.
I do think like one of the delicate balancing acts this movie has to pull off is in the last 5 minutes, my wife turns to me and he's like, right, a man died. And it's like, for this movie to work, you kind of can't think about how a person was murdered.
Yeah.
And like it, but also the person, it can't just be that they stole a can of tuna fish and got pulled over for that, because they did commit that crime. So,
yeah.
Even if it was unintentional. So like it has to have those big stakes, but you can't think about them too much. Mm-hmm. So like, It's the threat is never really, we might go to prison for life, we might get executed. They raise both of those. It's like, I can't go to prison because I could get raped there. And it's like, so like the stakes are all out of whack. And I do think the movie would be well served by like doing the traditional crime thriller, Grisham legal thriller thing, but making it funny. But the thing is, the thing that they're parodying doesn't really exist yet. So it's like a parody in reverse. Uh-huh. Like, obviously, there's TV shows like L.A. Law at this point that are very popular. But this is very in the mode of Grisham to the degree that it's set in the South. And yet Grisham is just starting his.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the firm is the next year. So, I mean, I think
the book is published in 91 and, of course, becomes an instant bestseller. So maybe they were aware of it. But this came out so early in 92 that I would not be surprised if they had no idea.
I mean, to your question, Katie, I also feel like the actual, I don't want to say crime solving component of this, but like the police aspect of this, the case itself is so dumb and so thin that on some level, I feel like they could have done a better job of making the case tighter, right? So because like, you know, they didn't do it, and you know that these cops are bumbling, and listen, I'm all for dumb cops, but I just feel like watching it this time anyway, I was just sort of like, how did this ever get to trial? How did we even get to this place, right? Like, what lawyer would take this case? What sheriff? He knows the intonation of the person who's saying, I shot the clerk. He's not saying it like he shot the clerk. Like, don't be an idiot. And you know what I mean? Like, that type of stuff, I found a little annoying this time.
Obviously, well, so it starts to fall apart if you think too much about it. So better just keep it all very vague.
Obviously, like, you want characters in movies to be smart so they can foil each other or whatever. But to some extent, the thing that's aged best about this movie is that the cops are lazy, arrest the first people they find, book them on completely pointless evidence, and then just trust that the court system will believe what they say and put these people in jail. Like, if not for Vinny, that's what would have happened.
And also, so, like, if you thought, like, if you are paying attention to the tire tracks, or if you're, like, thinking, like, it might spoil the reveal at the end of it, like, this is where I went back and forth on, like, how much it should tell us about what they know. Like, if we had seen Vincent interviewing the guy being like, so you're cooking your breakfast, then, like, it's queuing you up a little bit. So maybe I'm not mad at them for leaving
the Deus Ex Machina is crazy in this movie. Like, it is crazy that, like, she develops her photos and he sees them all in like, the last 5 minutes. I mean, it's pretty insane.
When they pull into town and Marissa Tomei's like, we got a problem with the car. Just seeing that, my wife was like, oh, she's going to win the case because she knows something about cars. Neither of us had seen this movie.
Wow.
I mean, obviously, we watch a lot of movies. We have terminal screenwriting brain. But it's very much like that was like, oh, we're setting this up. We got to pay it off somewhere. Yeah. But there's other stuff that feels like a setup that goes nowhere, like the protesters outside the prison for the guy who's going to be executed.
What was that about?
You're like, this is going to, like, Vinny's going to, like, see this guy, and that's going to set up the stakes. Or Vinny's going to see this guy, realize he was wrongfully convicted. You're just like, but no, it never goes anywhere. He dies.
So the writer of this movie, Dale Launer, Ruthless People, Blind Date, Dirty Rotten Soundrels. I mean, this guy's, you know, he's doing well in the 80s. It makes sense. These are, And again, like none of these movies are particularly plotty. All of them are just sort of like yada yada. Don't worry about what's going on in the plot. Like here are the jokes and here's some ultimately fodder for good comedy people. Your Danny DeVito's, your Bette Midler's, Steve Martin, what have you. And then he just kind of, he does a movie called Love Potion Number 9, which also he directed in 1992, which I don't imagine we're going to cover.
Somehow I have seen that movie.
Really?
That, like, I'm looking at his filmography. That, until My Cousin Vinny, that was the only movie written by him that I'd seen.
Interesting.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is a huge touch point for Libby, so I think we got to watch that at some point. Sure. But yeah, I'm probably
then the Hustle
better
is
than Love Potion Number 9.
Is a remake.
That's a VHS cover. The Love Potion Number 9 VHS cover is something I can picture in my head. Like, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Tate Donovan, Sandra Bullock.
Sure. Yeah.
He makes it's about a guy who makes a love potion, which is not at all troubling.
Not at all. And then he doesn't do anything until 2005 when he writes and directs a movie called Tom's New Heaven, which doesn't even have a Wikipedia link. So that doesn't really exist. And then The Hustle, which was a remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which he has, I guess, some sort of a screenwriting credit on. So, I mean, listen, this is, again, pretty basic screenwriting rules as to what he's doing. I think that it's all about intent, right? Which is Jonathan Lynn understands the movie that he's making. I think that the cast understands the movie they're making. You're either on the ride or you're not. The buy-in obviously is that this case is incredibly flawed, but you want to go along and see how Vinny and Mona Lisa figure it out. And again, like it's not rocket science. It's just, you know,
I was surprised how big Jonathan Lynn's career is. His filmography is wild. Easy. Like I had no idea he also made Clue.
Yep.
He made The Whole Nine Yards. Like he made, it seems like he alternated between movies that are like cultural touchstones and then shit like Nuns on the Run where you're like, okay.
Yeah. Like it's like, what are these movies? I mean, I will say too, though, he's British. And I do think that, so the whole Utes thing was because that was how Pesci said it to Jonathan Lynn, and Jonathan Lynn did not understand what he was saying. Huh. So that actually comes. I do think that there's like a British sensibility of how he sees America that I think is also playing into this in a way. And it's not like clunky, heavy-handed, but like I do think there's a little bit of that outsidery kind of perspective that I think is helping his films connect.
Yeah, it's interesting the way that it treats the South. Like it doesn't really get into race at all, which is very interesting for Mississippi Burning and only been a couple of years earlier. Right. Like it's a pretty diverse range of faces that you're seeing in this town is, and it's not entirely white. Like, I mean, many small Southern towns are mostly just white and black people at this point. So it makes sense. Sure. But it kind of skips a lot of like Southern culture clash things that you would expect. I wonder if the Britishness of the director is some of why you see that. I don't think it would be a better movie if it had more of that stuff in there. But I think kind of the clubbiness of small Southern towns, the suspicious of outsiders, like it's played very lightly and, another version of this movie could have gone a lot deeper into it, but I don't know if it would have been better.
I do wonder if they had cast Stiller and Smith as the friends. Like that automatically like gives you that. It's just this movie's kind of from the last era when you can just depict the South as A, you can just be like, they're a bunch of bumbling idiots. Don't worry about those guys. And B, you can kind of sort of be like, racism, we're aware it exists, but we're going to pretend it's not there for the length of this movie. You make this movie even 5 years later and you kind of, I think it's because of Clinton. Clinton gets elected and everyone has to be like, now we have to acknowledge that the South can produce Bill Clinton. But also like people start to talk more about race in a serious manner. Obviously that was happening in 92, but like it does feel like the movies about that topic became more ubiquitous later in the 90s.
Yeah,
I totally agree. The names in this movie, Vincent LaGuardia Gambini and Mona Lisa Vito.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
what have we got against that?
I mean, nothing. I mean, just crazy. I mean, listen, I'm not Italian. I don't think that any of us on here are Italian. I imagine that if I was an Italian person, I might take umbrage with the perspective of the way that these cartoonish characters are portrayed. But there's something really lovable about it. It doesn't feel as though it's malicious at all. It feels like it's just, but I don't know. What do you guys think about the Italian portrayal?
I wonder how, because like obviously Goodfellas is such as kind of like a landmark Italian American thing, obviously not showing everyone in like the perfect light, but you know, Pesci is such an icon of that. And so I wonder if it's a sense being like, ah, he's our guy, he can do whatever he wants. Like
that way.
I mean, Italians, like Godfather 3 is at what point around this? Like, I don't, there's been a lot of strong Italian American representation on film at this point. Like maybe they're fine.
I like, I mean, you think about the original Godfather got like Italian American groups were like, hey, this movie should not exist. I've been doing some research into It's a Wonderful Life for a thing that I'm thinking about writing. Okay. And it's, you know, there's a bunch of Italian immigrants in that movie. And at the time that would have been understood as basically diversity. It's like, here's this group of people who you don't normally see on film and we're going to present them as humanized, but also they're all going to have really thick accents.
Yeah.
And like Frank Capra was an Italian immigrant. So like it was personal to him. It was like a story he was trying to tell. And I think we've talked about this on the show before, but I think a lot about how a lot of American, what we now would call racism, we at the time would have been thought of as racism, and now we would not think of it that way. But like a lot of American sentiment against Italians and Irish people, like bears a lot of the hallmarks of, you know, how we've always treated immigrants, but B, also like how our society can be so racist. And then we kind of skipped over the part where we realized those stereotypes are harmful and just were like, now you're part of the culture.
And we can keep making fun of you.
Yeah. It feels like even like when I was growing up, like Polish jokes were a big thing. And it feels like there was a moment of reckoning where it was like, maybe we shouldn't do this. And now nobody tells Polish jokes.
Yep.
And yet if I use a broad Italian accent here and talk like Mario, everyone's going to be like, yeah, that's normal. We do that all the
time. It's weird. It's weird how there are some like, I mean, minorities we're okay with it in some, I don't know.
I think we've had several Irish American presidents now, you know, like Irish Americans and Italian Americans have a great degree of cultural power. So there is a certain level of like, it feels like, okay to sort of joke about that, but it's definitely like within a generation, we went from these people are immigrants and like, you know, that's a thing that we make fun of for malicious reasons too. These people have a lot of power and we jokingly make fun because we're all friends here.
I would argue that the fish out of water thing for them is more connected to the New Yorkiness of it than being Italian. Like them showing up in black leather and like talking about Chinese food and not knowing what grits are. You know, like I got married in my hometown in South Carolina 10 years ago and like my friends all came from New York and, you know, my mom's friends would be like, oh, I saw the New Yorkers walking down the street. And this isn't like a much bigger town than this town in Alabama. But there definitely is an aspect of that for like people who come from New York to a small southern town. So they maybe get away with it more from that perspective.
I think that is a thing that works in the favor of especially like Italian American stereotypes is they're so often just like, oh, it's New York. Cause it like a lot of the time, you know, I think that this is also the period of Seinfeld where people are like saying it's very New York. And sort of what they mean is like, this is about Jewish people.
Yeah.
Like it's very much like New York is this place of a cultural melting pot. And therefore you can sort of like use that as a descriptor for a lot of different things.
I would
say
also, I mean, a little bit of the Irish Boston thing too is kind of plays into this as well. So on the Joe Pesci of it all, I was looking at his filmography, which you think is interesting. Obviously, you know, Raging Bull is when he's kind of noticed and he's in a bunch of stuff, but it's really Lethal Weapon 2, I think, that really kind of big hit movie, a sort of larger than life character for him to play, which he goes back to two more times. Goodfellas, obviously, he wins in 90, the Oscar. He's got Goodfellas and Home Alone in 90. I mean, just the 1-2 punch that every actor dreams of, I'm assuming.
It's incredible. That was it. Like, because did Goodfellas come out in the fall? Like, did they come out within a couple months of each other? Yes. Yeah, what a run.
Like, just an unbelievable thing. He's in a comedy that doesn't hit in 91 called The Super. And then JFK plays David Ferry and he's amazing in JFK, as is everyone. And then in 92, he's got My Cousin Vinny, Lethal Weapon 3, a movie called The Public Eye, and Home Alone 2. So like he's got four movies in 92. Now, obviously he works a lot, but then kind of just stops working. Obviously he retired essentially. But I do think it's kind of amazing. You know, it's like, it's Casino, it's With Honors, Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag, Lethal Weapon 4. Like, it's just, it is what it is. But he's amazing in The Irishman, and I actually might have given him the Oscar for The Irishman.
This period.
Are we going to bring up The Irishman? Are we going to fight now?
We're not going to fight. No fighting.
Yes. Great film, The Irishman. Mm-hmm. This period in Hollywood when everyone's like, here's a short guy who talks kind of funny, let's make him a star, is mm-hmm. like such a, you know, A, it's such a great thing, but also B, like, yeah, a very much a sign of like how dominated Hollywood was by male voices at this point.
I do wonder though, Emily, do we cover his one episode of SNL that he hosted where it was him and the Spin Doctors?
Oh, that sounds
wow.
good. That sounds good.
That does sound good.
That's 1992. Just right there.
Yeah.
It's just funny to me that in this period of the 90s, like, Joe Pesci is a brand. Like, you put him in Home Alone because you know what to expect from him. And you put him in My Cousin Vinny because the idea of Joe Pesci in a Southern courtroom is like automatically funny. And like, if you're like, I was a kid at this point, like, I knew him from Home Alone. I didn't see Goodfellas until much, much later. Sure. He had like a four quadrant career where like you could know him from one thing and have no awareness of it on the other side. And he made that work for like 5 years.
I mean, I was such an Oscars head that like I watched those Oscars where he won for Goodfellas and I just very confidently said, this is really for Home Alone.
I mean, one of the best acceptance speeches ever.
Didn't hurt. Like, he was in just this crazy massive hit, you know, 3 months before the Oscars or whatever.
It is like sometimes a big hit comedy will come out during like someone who's doing an Oscar campaign and it doesn't work for them. This is the rare case where like people were like, that movie's kind of junky, but he's so fun in it that like it helped. Yeah,
it's the reverse Norbit is what we call it in Oscars.
I mean, it's true. His acceptance speech, which notoriously just goes up and says,
It was my pleasure. It was my honor. Yeah. It was my privilege.
And then he left. Yeah. It's phenomenal. That's the same year that Whoopi wins for Ghost as well.
Yeah.
You know, and then the next year.
Wow.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, which is
pretty. And then crazy. Jack Palance wins the year after.
Yeah.
What a time for comedic performances.
This is what I'm saying. Like, we used to do this.
Yeah.
And now it's like not even a question. These things don't even enter the. I mean, the last time I think it was even was Melissa McCarthy for Bridesmaids is the last one that I think people were like, she's not going to win, but she'll get a nomination.
Excuse me. Emma Stone won an Oscar for Poor Things this year, and that is an extremely funny performance.
It is.
I disagree, but it's...
Yeah. I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is another fringe case, I would say. But it's, sure. I mean, if in terms of like a, here is a comedy made to be funny and make audiences laugh. I mean, as we've said, like, they don't make that many of them anymore. You know, like Allison Janney and I, Tonya is a comedic performance, but like, that's not what that movie is.
It's true.
But yes, I think like Melissa McCarthy is like much more in the vein of Marissa Tomei than Amazon and Poor Things or something.
If we're just talking about like here is a comedy that is marketed as a comedy and is like, I do think Poor Things is a comedy, but let's
I know what you're saying.
Setting that aside, probably the last time there's buzz for something like that is Tiffany Haddish or Girl Strip.
Yeah. Right.
It feels like she almost got nominated.
But you had like a string there where you had like Kevin Kline winning for A Fish Called Wanda. You had Jack Palance winning for City Slickers, Marissa Tomei, I mean, I know that obviously Whoopi is funny in Ghost, but Ghost is not a comedy per se. But yeah. It is just interesting.
But Ghost is also a big mainstream movie. And this is a period where, like, Oscar bait in capital letters, like the way we think about that, doesn't exist anymore. You know, Marissa Tomei is up against like Howard's End and Enchanted April. That stuff was everywhere. So for them to go for these big mainstream movies was something.
And it's like, you know, when people win Oscars for comedic performances, it's usually for a movie that's attempting to have a redeeming social message. And like City Slickers and My Cousin Vinny certainly have elements of them that are like, My Cousin Vinny's like about how you should probably support your fiance on some level. But like, that's not like saying, you know, big important things about feminism in the way
that I think Jonathan Lynn thinks it's anti-death penalty, which like
he does.
Okay. Like, sure. Yeah, it's a pro-death penalty. Sorry, Emily, I cut you off.
No, you're fine.
I do want to just talk very briefly about something that I discovered that I texted you, Emily, that I still, which I think is fine, kind of crazy, which is that Marissa Tomei does not get nominated for a Golden Globe.
Right. No, she doesn't get nominated for anything.
She doesn't get nominated for
anything. Well, because supporting actress at Golden Globes is all put together. Yeah. So it wouldn't have been like a best actress.
Let's see who was nominated.
They should have run her right now. Lead if they didn't.
Joan Plowright for Enchanted April, Geraldine Chaplin for Chaplin, Judy Davis, Husbands and Wives, Miranda Richardson for Damage, and Alfre Woodard for Passion Fish, which
would have been, she should have
been great. She should have been nominated. So you're not wrong, Katie, that like because they smush drama and comedy together for the Golden Globes in supporting, but still kind of crazy. I'm looking at these nominations, Emily, for the Golden Globes that year. Pretty crazy. Musical or comedy, you had The Player, Aladdin, Enchanted April, Honeymoon in Vegas, and Sister Act.
Great movies all.
I mean, okay, but hang on. The nominees for actress at the Golden Globes. Miranda Richardson wins for Enchanted April, which I've never seen. Gina Davis in A League of Their Own. Whoopi Goldberg in Sister Act. Meryl Streep in Death Becomes Her. And then Shirley MacLaine in You Speech of People, which I've never seen. But that's three of the best performances of the 90s in that category.
I agree with you 100%. Pretty crazy. I mean, then in actor, you have Tim Robbins for The Player, Nicolas Cage for Honeymoon in Vegas, Billy Crystal for Mr. Saturday Night, Marcello Mastroianni for You's People, and Tim Robbins again for Bob Roberts. And Tim Robbins completely, just no one even acknowledges it at the Oscars.
Well, you know,
Go ahead, Emily.
I think The Player was like one of those things where it seemed like it was going to get a lot of nominations and underperform because it made everybody nervous. It got it's under like their
December
skin.
All over again.
I am on the Wikipedia page for Used People, which is such a Moonstruck knockoff that poster I'm dropping in the chat also, like it's a moon with like a squirrely font, it's like crazy. Jessica Tandy in the Olympia Dukakis role in the, I've never seen this movie, but like it seems very poster, pure though. Moonstruck core.
100%.
This looks so good though. Let's watch it. This looks so good. Well, are we going to cover Lethal Weapon 3 before we switch to our new Nebulous? Because I've never seen a Lethal Weapon at all.
It's unfortunate that the third one would be the first one that you would see.
It feels to me like I remember how much Siskel and Ebert loved those movies. And I was always like, I should watch them. And I never have. It does feel like now at this point in time, I'm going to be like, what's this all about? But
yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts on Lethal Weapon, Katie? Do you have thoughts?
I don't think I've ever seen a Lethal Weapon either. Like, wow. Late 80s, early 90s period where I'm a kid, but not old enough to see a bunch of these movies. There's a lot of stuff from that period that I've just never gone back to.
I think.
The first one is the prototype for so many movies. I mean, it's Shane Black's first script. Yeah. It's, you know, Donner doing an R-rated film. The cop buddy comedy, everything kind of comes off. I mean, I guess 48 Hours predates it, but still, there is just sort of, I mean, the first movie, and I I'm not going to make any excuses for Mel Gibson. It's the only Mel Gibson movie that I can still watch.
I mean, I don't know. Mel Gibson contributed a lot to the culture. Like, I think it is okay to admit that you can watch a Mel Gibson movie.
No, sure.
He's a monster.
I think, let me rephrase. It's the only one that I can kind of really divorce that from. I can still watch other movies of his, but it's still kind of there. Whereas Lethal Weapon, for whatever reason, is kind of one that
how many Mel Gibson movies are there where you're like, if you cut this out of culture, we would have nothing left? Like a lot of it, like Braveheart, fine, just like go.
Ransom? It's like you can live without Ransom.
I think I can live without ransom. I'd have to really go back and figure out, like, what do we need to keep from Mel Gibson's contribution?
It's, okay, yeah. It's the Lethal Weapon franchise and Daddy's Home 2. That's it.
And everything else can go. I will just say, though, the Marissa Tomei thing at the Golden Globes is a little strange only because of the comedy, and I put that kind of in capital letters. These supporting actor nominations are pretty indicative of what happens at the Oscars outside of Geraldine Chaplin and Alfre Woodard don't get nominated, but in their place, it's Vanessa Redgrave and Marissa Tomei. Vanessa Redgrave, who's really good in Howard's End.
I really would have, like, I think the thing that holds her back is she's only in the first half hour.
Correct.
And Marissa Tomei's big moments are all at the end. I think that helps her. Yep. I remember at the time, a number of people were predicting Marissa Tomei because she's the only American in the category.
True.
And at that point, the Academy was still very American focused. Probably if it's right now, you know, that award goes to some boring British lady. So,
so in rewatching the Oscar clip last night, Jack Palance goes off script and says that the five nominees are all foreign-based people.
And he thinks Marissa Tomei is Italian?
Well, no. Then Marissa Tomei looks around like, what? And he goes, and someone from Brooklyn, which I think is kind of a funny joke that is just whatever. But I think you're right, Emily. I think that you've got four Brits and, you know.
Yeah.
Can I just say really briefly, I find Jack Palance's Oscar win slightly baffling. Like, he's good in that movie. He's in it for maybe 10 minutes. He's like, I don't know that he had the sort of, and obviously I'm too young to really know, but like the legendary career that, like, obviously he's in Shane, which is a fucking classic. But like, other than that, I'm like, what? That was one of those ones where, like, I think I'm slightly older than you, Katie, but in a similar boat where, like, the late 80s, early 90s, all these movies I wasn't seeing, but I was watching the Oscars and I would see them in the Oscars. And then years later, I would be like, well, I got to see Jack Palance's.
I got to see City Slickers.
And you watch City Slickers and you're like, what?
I will say that this is one of those, like, Tommy Lee Jones loses for JFK.
Yeah.
And then wins the next year or 2 years later.
2 years later, yeah.
For Fugitive. It feels like he should have won for JFK.
I'm glad he didn't win for JFK, which it's kind of
good in that movie. I know it's an icky performance, but
he's
good in it.
It's an icky performance. I would rather celebrate him winning for, like, a fucking iconic role.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, are you going to take away from the Fugitive? Although, like, then you got to follow it. Like, if he loses for the Fugitive, does Leonardo DiCaprio win? And then, like, all of history is changed from there. It's, like, you got to follow that trail.
And then you talk about performances that don't age well. Leonardo DiCaprio's performance. Yeah. What's Eating Gilbert Grape is not one.
Okay, fine. Ralph Fiennes wins for Schindler's List, and then we don't have to stress about Ralph Fiennes finally winning an Oscar, which I'm personally very stressed about.
I am stressed about it too.
I do think that if Tommy Lee Jones had lost it, like, it would have been Fiennes, but, like, that's DiCaprio's choices aside, I think that's one of the best runs that category's ever had. That's a, like, five iconic performances, iconic in kind of a strange way for DiCaprio, but certainly, like, people remember that performance.
So. Sure.
No, absolutely. I mean, listen, the Oscars, we've talked about a fair amount here and there, but Katie, obviously, with your Oscar knowledge and what have you, the 1992 Oscars, do you have thoughts about Unforgiven? Do you have thoughts about sort of these winners that year? I'd be remiss.
Hang on, I have so many Wikipedia pages open. I got to figure out which one is for the 92 Oscars. Again, this is my period where I'm young enough that there's still a bunch of these movies that I've never seen. I've never seen The Crying Game. And, like, I know the twists in The Crying Game. So, like, but people say it's pretty good besides that, right?
It's better. It's honestly it's the twist. Than you think. The twist is its reputation is based so much more on things like Ace Ventura that are parodying it.
Uh-huh.
It's not great. I'm not going to sit here and say it's iconic trans representation, but that film is, like, kind to its trans character in a way that basically no other movies around that time were.
Yeah.
So, like, it's a mixed bag, but, like, the actual mystery of it's pretty good. The stuff about, like, being in the IRA is pretty good. It's a solid movie that I think has been overshadowed by the people who ripped it off.
I also would say too, Katie, for what it's worth, mm-hmm. the twist that you're speaking of comes about 45 minutes before the end of the movie.
Does it really?
The movie's
really?
Not really about that reveal. It's about him grappling with this knowledge that he's, anyway, but
yeah, go ahead.
The Crying Game is such an interesting preview, because that was a Miramax movie. Like, it's such an interesting preview of where the Oscars are going to head, like this small movie that's going to come and like run the table on that. So it's interesting to see kind of a whole new kind of Oscars be born while it's up against like Howard's End or, you know, Unforgiven being a classical Hollywood thing. So I'm always interested in seeing how trends emerge like that, which is where I was like, I get where The Crying Game fits in Oscar history and I haven't seen it, but that's only part of the story. I don't think I'm ever going to see Scent of a Woman unless you guys are going to talk me into it. Never seen it.
What do you think?
Skip it.
I think it's pretty skippable.
Of the five movies nominated, that we've watched all of them now, and like I can find value and appreciate the other four, and Scent of a Woman should be fired into the sun.
You know what I would like to see now, because I haven't seen, is Chaplin, now that Robert Downey Jr. is an Oscar winner. I feel like that one could go. Really? Is it that bad?
It's so bad.
Wow.
I find Scent of a Woman more risable in terms of, honestly, not even what it's saying about women, but what it's saying about mental health, I think is awful. Chaplin, just on a raw bones level, is a much worse movie. It's so boring.
It doesn't have a reputation, right? It's just like, we all know that he got the nomination for it, and like, and then we moved on. Never talked
He's
about it
very again. Good in it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Not to take anything away from Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, but it is all of the like, bad instincts about biopics that we all know. It literally tries to do, like, you know, Tomb to Womb or Womb
to Tomb.
It's a whole thing.
You remember the scene in the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man where Spider-Man's designing his costume and like trying out a bunch of different things?
Uh-huh.
Chaplin does that with Charlie Chaplin coming up with the tramp, but it is a million times slower and it treats it with the reverence of like, here is Jesus Christ looking at a cross and being like, I bet I'm gonna die on one of those someday.
It's crazy.
Well, like, you guys have watched so many movies from 92. Do you feel like the Oscars really got it wrong that year?
I think they easily could have come up with a better
Best
Picture category. I don't think, like, the only movie in there that I personally would nominate is Unforgiven, and the grievous way they overlooked Malcolm X is truly unfortunate. Like,
that's,
I'm not going to sit here and say my favorite movie from the year is Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. I don't think the Oscars should have nominated that. That's really not in their wheelhouse.
Although we did talk about how Cheryl should have gotten a nomination.
She should have been nominated. But yeah, it is a year when it feels like there's those last gasps of the 80s, very British Merchant Ivory imitators, and we're about to enter the years of Miramax just dominating. And obviously Schindler's List year is a interesting
The thing. I think 93 is a real fulcrum point. That feels like it's when we really become the 90s, you know, when you have Schindler's List and Jurassic Park being sort of these towering things. And 92 feels like a little bit of a sort of neither fish nor fowl year, not to take anything away from Unforgiven, which I do think is a great movie.
It's amazing.
But all these other movies, you're just sort of like, I mean, I love A Few Good Men. I've watched it a million times, but, you know, again, I don't, you know, I will say this though. It is a little surprising that Rob Reiner doesn't get a nomination for it. And again, I'm not like going to sit here and say Rob Reiner, you know, deserve to win or anything like that. But the run he's on at that time in his career is pretty unimpeachable. And it's a little bit surprising that like Altman slips in there with The Player, which is a great movie.
The same thing happened with Ron Howard. That's the thing where they their first Oscar movie and the Oscars are like, Welcome, my dude. You don't get the director nomination, but you get Best Picture. And if you keep doing this, we're going to give you Best Picture and Best Director someday. And Rob Reiner immediately falls off a cliff.
And makes North. That's his that's his version of A Beautiful Mind.
It is interesting, though, on the Rob Reiner of it all, because I stand by the fact that I think that Apollo 13 is still maybe his best movie. It's certainly like the movie that he directed. Yeah.
Seems pretty undebated. Like, not maybe undebated, but like that's a pretty good take.
So it is just kind of like, and then he just gives them Oscar pablum with fucking A Beautiful Mind, and they're like, great, and they just eat it up.
I think the Oscars are occasionally susceptible to a twist, and A Beautiful Mind does have a twist, and I think that's what happened. It's just like,
I hate that movie. I can't wait for
it's so bad. It's so bad, but like it's like really it was. Bad. It was the thing where it was like, here's a twist. And the Oscars were like, holy fucking shit, there was a twist.
I mean, yeah, it's sure.
There are many reasons the Sixth Sense got a bunch of Oscar nominations. It's a very well-made mm-hmm. movie. It's a huge hit. But like sure. that twist did not hurt it. The Oscars love yeah. a twist.
Yep.
As you said, Katie, you didn't watch a lot of films in 1992. You watched films, but just not.
I'm trying to Sister Act, A League of Their Own, like see this, any movie that you could have gone to see when you're 8 years old.
You know, you just mentioned it, and I do think we talked about this on our episode about it, Emily, but A League of Their Own is a surprising omission from the Oscars in 92 because it was such a hit.
Yes, but to say, is it surprising for that period? And it's like, it's funny, Madonna's in it, like sports movies in the Oscars, I feel like can be hit or miss.
There's a world where Gina Davis got in, but like, that's mm-hmm. like, I think that's its Oscar ceiling in a weird way. Yeah.
Well, because she had been nominated for Thelma and Louise, which is also like a girl movie,
directed by a man. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why it counts. So you can imagine them being like, okay, Gina, we did it this time. We're not going to do it again.
That's like, really I think, Phil, you're underestimating the amount of misogyny that still exists in Hollywood, but in the early 90s.
No, for sure. I mean, listen, look at what, you know, this year was sort of an example of it to some degree, too, in terms of some of the stuff that they turned their nose up, Barbie in particular. But I do think that, like, I don't know. And again, I'm looking back. I was 12. I think A League of Their Own is still unimpeachably wonderful. It was a hit. It's filled with great performances. It's maybe my favorite Hanks performance. I'm just sort of like, it's kind of crazy to me that it was just totally blanked. But, you know, what do you know?
I think it got a song nomination, did it?
I don't even got a song.
Ooh, I don't think so. That song. I could live without that song of all the things I love about it.
But
This used to be my playground. Oh yeah, I remember.
Was that written for the film? I feel like I remember that being disqualified for some reason.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's so weird for her to not write that song for like of their own. I guess it's not like this used to be my like baseball.
I mean, listen, it was going up against The Bodyguard and Aladdin, both getting two nominations each. It wasn't really, it didn't really have a chance, but you know.
It was written for the film, but because of Madonna's contract, it couldn't be on the film's soundtrack album, and therefore it appeared on the soundtrack album for the 1992 Olympics, and somehow that disqualified it.
That's incredible. That is some trivia shit. Someone needs to like, that's incredible.
The 1992 Olympics had a soundtrack album is what I'm still stuck on here. I don't understand what the goal was there. I mean, the really crazy thing is that the iconic song from The Bodyguard is there as a cover, so therefore it's also not Oscar eligible. Yeah, so like you've exactly. got two Bodyguard nominations that are good songs that aren't quite there, but A Whole New World wins, which I'm not going to argue with that.
Yeah. So I have a question for you guys. Did you clock the age difference between Joe Pesci and Marissa Tomei in this movie? Was that something that stuck out to you?
I thought about it.
The 22-year difference between the two of them?
I do think that Joe Pesci reads younger than he is, which helps a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Genuinely, I think it might be the height, which is like a very shitty thing for me to say, but I think that's like how he reads on screen. And also, they're styling him to look younger. They've really dyed his hair.
Yeah, all that hair he's got on top of his head. Yeah, and I think he's like, he graduated from law school like 10 years earlier. Sure. So you're kind of expecting him to be in his 30s. How old is
he
actually?
They're doing some pulling on the side.
Oh, you think so?
They're definitely doing that. So I'm just, just saying. It was just something that I kind of noticed. Maybe it's just that Marissa seems young, right?
She seems young.
So it's less that he seems old and more that she seems young. And again, like I'm not saying it was gross, but it was just a thing that I flagged.
Yeah,
just a thing
that I was like, he's 49, and when they make this movie, and when this movie's released, I should say, and she's 27, 28. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you kind of believe it, though. Like, she grew up around her older brothers, and he was hanging out at the auto shop. Like, you can kind of see.
No, for sure.
Maybe I'm just remembering, like, in Goodfellas, where, like, young women come in and out of those guys' lives all the time. Just like, sure.
No, I bought it. They have chemistry, too, to be clear. Like, they really do work well off of each other. I didn't know this, and maybe you knew this, Emily. You might even own the album that Joe Pesci put out in 1998 called Vincent LaGuardia Gambini Sings Just For You.
I wish I did. Let me see if I can find it on Spotify. I'm going to start blasting it as soon as we're done here.
But that was a thing.
I understand. Did he have the rights to the character to make that album? No idea. Did he do it illegally? I'm fascinated by the existence of this.
Oh, here it is. It's on Spotify. I'm going to read you the track list. Yo, Cousin Vinny. Mm-hmm. The first song. Wise Guy, Take Your Love and Shove It. I've Got News for You. How Do You Like Me So Far? Robbie Hood, 21. Old Man Time, He'll Have to Go. I Can't Give You Anything But Love. Christmas Song, If It Doesn't Snow on Christmas. What a Wonderful World is the closing track. And then there's bonus tracks on this version of the album, which are the song Yo, Cousin Vinny, recorded in the languages Italian and Spanish.
Spanish. I didn't see that one coming.
Oh, Emily, I can't believe you don't know that Christmas song.
Technically in Spanish, Yo, Cousin Vinny is
I Cousin Vinny. Does it have an exclamation mark at the beginning and at the end?
It's fantastic. Other things that I wanted to just talk about as we sort of breeze through. We've talked about most of the plot, but there are Bruce McGill, who's always great. Love seeing him show up. Wish he was kind of in the movie more.
I fucking loved Herman Munster as the judge.
God. Oh my God, Fred Wayne. Holy crap.
I love that performance. I was like, how did they make Herman Munster look so much like Edward Herman? And they just they did.
Yeah, and he really does look like Edward Herman.
I agree that this movie hits the beat of him trying to figure out Vinny's secret a few too many times in a way that kind of makes him feel stupid, but also made me realize that they don't have the internet, so they can't just Google somebody. But it is he's so good that you see why they kept going back to that well. Because they'll cut to reaction shots of him just being like, and you're like, great, great work. I do think I sort of dismissively talked about this as a VHS movie earlier, but I do think a quality of that is that he's very good at pitching his performance to television.
Absolutely.
In a way. Obviously, it also works on the big screen. I can imagine it working, but on TV, it just reads perfectly.
I absolutely agree. Sorry, please.
I think the first time I watched this, I'm off on the Southern accent cop. And so if the accents are wrong, I get really irrationally angry. And for Fred Gwynne, I was like, oh, well, clearly he's an Atlanta actor. I didn't really put together who he was. And when I looked it up, I was like, oh, this is all a performance. His accent is perfect. And the Southern accents in this movie are really dead on. I was looking up Lane Smith, who's the prosecutor. He's born in the South. But I think a lot of other people are putting them on and they do a great job.
Yeah, James Rebhorn, who shows up, has a pretty good Southern accent. I thought he did. I mean, he was also in Sense of a Woman, for what that's worth. But James Rebhorn was such a great character actor and was amazing in everything that he was
doing. When I saw Lane Smith, I said, oh, that's Perry White. And my wife said, that's Lane Smith. And I said, no, he's Perry White in the Lois and Clark. And she said, that is Gordon Bombay's nemesis. So
he was busy in the 90s.
Yes, there's a lot of great character actors that show up in this, and it is worth noting that Austin Pendleton, who plays the stuttering DA, had a stutter as a child and was pretty upset about doing it because of the bad memories that it brought up, and then publicly talked about how that role was so big for him that it opened up doors, and that there was just a lot of conflicted feelings he had about it, which is fair. He is, and again, I don't know what to say about is stuttering funny? I don't know, but it did feel like it worked in the movie. It made sense in the movie, but I also get him not wanting to go down that road.
Maybe it's just my cultural sensitivity in the year 2024, but I watched that scene. I was why is this supposed to be funny? I'm not it felt.
That's fair.
It's obviously as a dramatic impediment, I understand why it works, but they go to that well so much. And it really drags down a section of the film when it's really starting to cook. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would have come up with a different reason this guy's back.
Yeah. I was just thinking about how he confidently pats the guy on the shoulder and steps up there and you're okay, we're going to see how it's really done. And the reveal of the study, it's funny to realize that he's going to fall apart too, but I was mm-hmm. He could have been sweating too much, or he could have forgotten. Yeah. There's so many things that they could have done, and it makes perfect sense that in 1992, it would not have occurred to them not to do this,
yeah.
but
yeah.
It does feel like they could have had the similar impact without necessarily stigmatizing the portion of the population.
This movie holds up so well that every time it's always just like a single scene of like, here's mm-hmm. a thing that now we're like, I don't know. And you could
rape thing
goes often yeah. lift it out and like go.
I mean, is there any comedy from the early 90s that doesn't, like, I haven't seen Sister Act in a while, but like, I'm guessing there's something like that in Sister Act that drives you crazy, or League of Their Own.
So bad.
It holds League up pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. League of Their Own isn't so bad either. I have a thing I call the queer phobia scale where I try to like keep an eye on this shit because there's all these movies have jokes about queer
this
people.
This one's pretty high on that.
This one's pretty high. But like, you know, some of the movies are like, they don't, Sister Act and League of Their Own, really, obviously League of Their Own should have had more lesbians in it, but like, we'll just assume.
Well, they fixed that. They did make a whole show to rectify their history on that.
I mean,
Marla Hooch deserved better, but other than that, I can't think of too much.
What's interesting is that the scene we were talking about where Stan mistakes Vinny for being a rapist, which I don't,
the prison rapist in a leather jacket, really, it doesn't make any sense.
None of it makes any sense. They get
to wear their clothes in jail for so long. They're just
That's also true.
Well, because they're like supposed to be in like the county lockup, right, awaiting trial, but they said something about it's like being renovated or something like that. So that's they're still in the there's something about why they're going to like the state penitentiary while they're awaiting trial, because you would normally not do that.
I imagine Jonathan Lynn like getting on set and picking up the script and being like, here's all the inaccuracies, we need to fix these. But then people are like, we've already got the locations and costumes. So he's like, we need to fix these in dialogue.
But what's interesting is that they originally cut the scene, the rape scene, or not the rape scene, but the, you know what I'm talking about. And then they put it back in for a test screening and it tested really well. And they were just like, all right, I guess we keep this in.
I mean, like, there's only so much you can do with the audiences of the time.
I do think a lot of this is just like, I think there is a certain thing in people, it's in everybody, where we want to like make fun of people. Mm-hmm. And like, this is a period when the people that you're okay making fun of are people with some sort of disability and people that are queer. And like, now, of course, we're like, well, fuck that. But like, I'm sure that 50 years from now, my kid's going to watch movies I thought were funny and be like, this is making fun of mom. How could you?
Yeah.
Actually, I'll be dead by then. So I don't care.
No, that is part of being a parent, is being like, yeah, we're doing our best, but these kids are going to catch stuff we can't see coming and we just have to live with that.
Yeah.
I do think it's so interesting how like, for the longest time, being a boomer was like a good thing, weirdly, and now it's curdled and it's like, will you please let go of your stranglehold of this culture and this world? But it's just interesting.
I think all the time about how growing up in the 90s, you're just like, well, the 60s were the most important decade that ever happened in human history. It's right? just like, I mean, again, to Forrest Gump, and it took so long for me to be like, wait, no, like, we can have our own culture. It doesn't just have to be what the boomers did.
And then when Gen X started to take over, they were like, although Gen X has never had real cultural power, but certainly they made us think the 80s were important, which is, I guess, their foremost contribution to culture.
The Wedding Singer being a real like watershed moment in that time. Yeah.
No, 100%.
And now I guess millennials are going to be like, guess what, everyone? The 2000s. And I'm like, really? Are we going to do this?
I feel like it's like the youth like telling us the 2000s are cool. And we're like, no, what? No, we can't do that again.
Listen, yeah,
it's not as though there's going to be a podcast that examines this, so it's going to be fun. I want to talk for a second about the scene. It's relatively early in the movie when Vinny is telling Mona Lisa about how scared he is, mm-hmm. and that he thinks he's gotten over his head, and it's a really kind of quiet scene where she tells him that she thinks he's going to do great unless he fucks it all up. But like, I think that a lesser movie wouldn't have even had this scene. Right. Like, I really do appreciate that they want to sort of give some ballast and some real emotional weight to what Vinny's going through. And I thought it was just a really nice scene. And I appreciate that they had that in there.
And it comes back with because that's the judge who she calls at the end of the movie, whatever his name was. It is interesting seeing Joe Pesci admitting to being scared, because that's not something you see in Goodfellas, any of the Home Alones. Like, I'm guessing not in Lethal Weapon. It's kind of not part of his toolkit until this movie, oddly.
I do think there's a vulnerability to Joe Pesci that like is understood, that this movie dials up just enough. And I think that could have been his star persona if he had become a bigger star. Mm-hmm. It's like, he's this tough guy who kind of like is like, he's coming in swinging, but because he's got a tiny bit of vulnerability, like that sets him apart from like some of the other guys in that same zone. But yeah,
that's what With Honors was trying to be. I mean, it's not a good movie. Have you guys seen With Honors? You know what this movie is? Where he plays an unhoused man who is taken under the wing of a bunch of Harvard law students.
Oh, no.
That sounds great.
The poster for this movie is
isn't it incredible?
Oh, Brendan Fraser. Wow, two Oscar winners on this poster.
Yeah, it is it's definitely channeling some what if we turn Joe Pesci into Robin Williams? Can we do that? Is that a thing we can do? Can we take the Poet Society and the Fisher King and blend them together?
Bill, can we just do a special With Honors episode, even though it's from 1984? Absolutely. Fucking Patrick Dempsey looks hot as hell in this.
I mean, 1994 is another fascinating year. Like, I don't know why you're not just moving through every year of the 90s, but
because Emily's tired of the 90s.
I love the 90s. I do feel like 1992 is like the 1980s. The party is over and there's a few stragglers there and they're all high as hell and you're like, go get out of here.
I agree with that 100%. I mean, With Honors, what's also interesting, not to keep going back to this, but when Marissa Tomei wins, it cuts to Joe Pesci in the audience because she thanks him, and he looks like the character from With Honors. He's grown the beard, and he looks just like
crazy.
I gotta watch
this.
But yeah, I mean, With Honors, guys, who knew? Bad movie. Anyway,
yeah, I don't think I'm watching that one. Gore Vidal is in it.
Yeah, it's a crazy movie. It's a different time.
Wow,
Emily's so fascinated.
This sounds good. I think this sounds good. I mean, Patrick Dempsey looks hot on the poster.
Patrick Dempsey does. He's got a lot of hair.
Yeah.
I mean, Patrick Dempsey never had a not hot period as far as I can tell. So
this is true. Mona Lisa, you guys mentioned this earlier, that she doesn't serve, quote unquote, a purpose for a large portion of the first half of the film. And I agree that it's all kind of a little bit of teeing up stuff. She does help by reading the book that Joe Pesci refuses to finish reading about law. And then has knowledge about various things like disclosure and things like that. So she does actually help him. She's kind of sort of a DA assistant in a weird way.
Yeah. She's there to be like, oh, you pretend to be that guy, huh? Oh, he's dead. Like, and their dynamic throughout that.
100%.
I mean, it's so much of the comedy of it, right? It's just them like yelling at each other, but then also being in love with each other. It's very sweet.
Yeah. I mean, you've got the deer scene, which is fantastic, where he says he's going to go hunting with the prosecutor. And she gives this beautiful speech about this deer and how it gets its head blown off.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like, Marissa Tomei is sinking her teeth into these speeches that she gets. You know, the one that turns into her Oscar speech when she's on the porch in that, what would
biological
you call
cloth
that
one?
Yeah, the biological. What is that?
It's a cat suit. It's like a floral cat suit with significant heels that the minute incredible. She steps off that porch, she can't walk at all.
She's banging her foot on the ground like it's her biological clock. And she's like, I don't know if I'm ever going to get married. Like, that was literally her Oscar clip.
Yeah.
And she's just, I don't know. It's kind of a lightning in a bottle thing. I'm sure there's a bunch of actresses that could have done it at the time, but there's something about the modulation and just everything that Marissa's bringing to it that I'm just like, it's undeniable.
Yeah. I mean, when a performance kind of just takes hold of the movie in that way, because like you don't necessarily see it coming that the entire finale is going to lean on her, but you've been wanting to see more of her the whole time. And it's like, you know, the whole movie's building up to like an action scene climax, except it's her testifying. It's so built for her.
It's also, and again, like not to harbor on sort of, you know, screenwriting 101, but it's like they're having a problem in their relationship. He gets really angry at her. And yells at her. She gets pissed off. So it's like he has to literally drag her into the courtroom. And through the course of her testimony of her being so good at this, they fall back in love with each other. It's good shit. It's movies. Yeah. I don't know.
But it's perfect that she won't answer his questions. Like he's brought her in to know something and she's trying, but it takes the prosecutor to doubt her knowledge. She's like, fuck you, I know this. And that's what gets her talking. It suits, and for what we know of the character at that point, it's so perfect.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I don't know anything about cars.
Neither do I.
But I assume everything she says is completely accurate. Mm-hmm. I think what makes this an Oscar-winning role is that scene. But what makes that an Oscar-winning scene is the whole movie. She's been nailing every punchline and she's not in enough of it. And you're like, she's really good. And then she's in the last half hour. But she's basically the lead of the last half hour. And Absolutely. You're like, great.
Doesn't that car speech remind you, though, Emily, of when you talk with Oscars about people being like, well, no, of course, Diane Warren wasn't not going to get nominated for the Flamin' Hot song. She's been nominated on 5-year track record. And before that, like you start rattling off facts about something you do know about. And you're like, obviously, everyone knows that.
I'm sure you are also waiting for when your knowledge of the Oscars will be incredibly important in a murder trial.
Yes. I want to go on the stand and have to rattle off everything that was nominated for Best Picture in 2011. And then my moment will come.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I'm going to show up at jury duty and the guy's going to be like, can you tell me which awards the artist won? And I'll be like, give me a second. I know I can pull all of them.
The Artist, a movie already forgotten to time, a movie that no one talks about.
You guys are going
to
do 2011 on your podcast series?
No. Yeah.
Podcast like it's 2011 sounds like when the heat death of the universe occurs.
I do think you mentioned this, Katie, that like she won't even look at him when he's trying to ask her questions.
He won't look at the photo of the tire track.
The photo, she's just like, she's, again, it's all good stuff. But then him just being, at one point, he sits down behind the desk and puts his feet up and says, watch this. And she just like goes off. It's,
yeah,
his love for her in that scene is pretty wonderful.
Yeah. And like when she realizes that they're like, she goes back to talking to him after talking to the prosecutor and she realizes that they're in sync and they're kind of putting on a show for everybody else. It's, mm-hmm. it's really beautiful.
It is. It all pays off really, really well.
Hang on. I'm going to keep interrupting you, but you're talking about how like the fake name thing kind of doesn't pay off, but the fact that he's trying to speed out of there before he gets caught at the very end is really funny. Like that payoff to that joke is worth it.
I agree. It's also, it made me think there's a moment when they drive off and like the entire cast of characters are standing on the steps of the courthouse. And I was like, remember the days when you just did that?
I love that. That's how I grew up in a tiny town. And if an outsider comes to that town, everyone stands on the courthouse steps. And there was like a period when you remember Manute Bol, the extremely tall NBA player who's grew up in Africa and like came to the US and played in, I think, for the Rockets. I don't remember the 90s at all, evidently, but like he came to town to speak at a church.
Sure.
And like there's like 700 people in my town. And I do genuinely think everyone like stood on the steps of the church and waved goodbye as Manute Bol drove out of town. So
that part.
Anytime there's someone from out of town who comes to your town, you're like, there they are.
Yeah.
Hi.
That part at the end of the courtroom made me think that it could be a good play. Like, I wonder if community theaters are doing My Cousin Vinny as a play. It could really work well.
It could be a play.
There's not a 100%. Ton of characters. You only need a couple locations and some fun roles to sink into. I like the musical. I would, maybe don't go that far. Just make it a play. Let the community theaters have a chance.
How is this the only movie from 1992 that there's not a musical?
Well, this version? Is the funny thing. Because Emily and I have talked about this. There was Honeymoon in Vegas, the musical. Mr. Saturday Night, the musical. Newsies, obviously. Are there others, Emily? Sister Act.
Aladdin, Sister Act, the musical. Leap of Faith, the musical.
Yeah, Leap of Faith.
Yeah.
God, there's so many.
I listened to the score for the Leap of Faith musical. It's kind of good. It's kind of good. We talked about it on the episode. It kind of slaps.
Do they announce A League of Their Own musical and never make it?
I think so, yeah.
That feels right.
I mean, that still feels like it'd be a great musical, personally, but...
Yeah. The thing about, like, development for Broadway musicals is that that thing could show up 10 years from now, and they'll be like, we've been working on this since 2009. And you'll be like, yep.
I mean, the Water for Elephants musical is about to debut on Broadway, like, that nobody asked for, as far as I know. They made a Water for Elephants musical. It's about to be on Broadway. Is there an elephant in it? Guess we got to go find out.
It's,
I hope not. Like a
war horse
Please
type
leave
elephant?
That elephant. Oh, yeah. Fake elephant. Fine. No real elephants allowed.
It's this is one of the most crowded Broadway seasons ever. It's just like a show after show after show after show, and they're all going to get ignored. But I hope Water for Elephants rises to the top.
I
you know, really what would be a good musical from 1992? Wayne's World. Do you think they developed that at some point?
Oh, God.
You could make hell out of a Wayne's World musical.
You would need to do like catalog songs. You could.
Yeah. It'd have to be a jukebox musical.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
They should do that. Aren't they trying to do... They did an ad with the two of them, right?
Yeah.
Like with Mike Myers and Dana Carvey, relatively
recently. Yeah.
Super Bowl a couple years ago.
And it was just depressing.
I genuinely think they should do Wayne's World 3. because I think there is something interesting in
of that
aging
mold
that you could explore.
I don't disagree with that. That actually could be fun. I mean, listen, Wayne's World 2 is such a shrug that, I mean, you could go back to that well, I guess. But also Mike Myers, man, it's grim.
When I was a kid, I preferred Wayne's World 2 to Wayne's World 1. I don't anymore, but I did.
I'm pleased to announce that in 2005, they announced a musical of Fried Green Tomatoes that doesn't seem to have gone anywhere. But that I'm just going down the list of 1992.
Fried Green Tomatoes. Is it a good movie, guys?
It's a weird movie. I did a podcast a couple years ago about all the supporting actors nominees for 1991, which was a fun. I saw The Fisher King for the first time, saw Cape Fear. Like I said at the beginning, like the early 90s in the South, things were weird and they were really obsessed with it. And Fried Green Tomatoes is right in there.
Cape Fear, right? That's
yeah. Oh, yeah. Well. Yeah.
I mean, not to go back to Scorsese. I do think that the last scene of this movie is great. There are two moments with Mona Lisa that I love, where she says, you know, this could be a sign of things to come. You win all your cases, but with somebody's help. You win case after case, and afterwards you have to go up to somebody and say thank you. Oh my God, what a fucking nightmare.
I love that. Yeah.
And then also him saying, what, you're not going to marry me now? No way. You can't win a case by yourself. You're fucking useless. It is. They do have a great banter. It's a great place to leave it. I love that she's driving. I love that she's in control of that scene. There's just something really, really wonderful about it. But to rate this movie, Katie, at the end of our episodes, we do a rating of 0 to 99, 0 being obviously the lowest, 99 being the highest, and 50 being the margin of which you would recommend a movie. Film in 92, as I mentioned, or around 92, 95, whatever. I liked it fine. I probably would have given it like a 65 back then. Like, I don't think that it just, you know, I think I'm at an 82. I think this movie, for the last 45 minutes, as we've all said, is just firing on all cylinders, that I'm willing to kind of sit through what might be a little bit of a saggy first, you know, half or what have you. So I'm at an 82. Where are you, Emily?
I would think I would give the first hour and 15 like a 60, and I would give the last 45 like an 85, which I think averages to like roughly a 73.
Okay,
do the math. That's just my assumption.
That's just off the dome.
73.
Sure.
A queerphobia scale like a 7. It's actually, it's like too high because I've had other movies that I've ranked low, but it did like that prison rape scene.
One scene is just
dire.
It's
brutal. Katie, what about you?
Before I start talking, in 2006, they also announced a Father of the Bride musical. So
it's a good one. Yeah.
Again, I don't think it ever got made. To the topic at hand, I was thinking 85. I think before we started talking, I would have said 90, but then you guys kind of pointing out to me that it kind of wasn't just me being like, oh, I can't run out of time before we record. Like, it does drag in the beginning of it. There is bagginess that you can't get around, but when you have something that good in the middle of something, like, I think you just got to treasure it. And again, they don't make movies like this anymore at all. So I treasure that too.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it is one of those, you hit play on it and it just, I don't know, it really knows what it is the thing too. I feel like today we have movies that are trying to scratch so many itches and check so many boxes. And this movie just, it's in the pocket. It knows what it's doing. Yeah. So next week, Katie, I'm curious to hear if you have thoughts on the film that we're covering next week. We're covering Gas Food Lodging. Have you ever seen Alice and Anders' Gas Food Lodging?
No, that's like an early Sundance hit, right?
It was. It was sort of, you know, Allison and Tarantino dated, and there was kind of a fusing of the two of them for a little bit there. Reservoir Dogs also being a 92 movie. We have Chandler Levack coming on to talk about it, writer-director who wrote and directed a great film called I Like Movies, which, God willing, will come out in the United States at some point. I saw it at TIFF a few years ago and absolutely loved it. Yeah, it's a great movie. Do you have thoughts on Alison Anders? Do you have thoughts on, I'm sure you haven't seen this.
I wish movie, I but. Did. No, I haven't. I know who she is and I know kind of her reputation as like a major figure of like 90s indie cinema. And, you know, I did like independent class, like film studies in college, and I didn't watch any of her movies. I mean, she hasn't made as many movies as she should have because that's how it goes. I feel like I got like a couple years ago, like enough Criterion's doing this, I started like promoting more like work done by women in the 90s. Like I saw Watermelon Women for the first time a few years ago. And I feel like, you know, Alison Anders' work is kind of worthy of a revival like that. So you guys are doing it. So well done. Yes,
we are shining a light on it. It's a great movie.
You know, the actor Robert Knepper, of Prison Break fame. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to look this up. Let me find out if I know him. Is he in Gas Food Lodging?
Yes. Here's the thing. He is the skeeziest creep in every role. And in Gas Food Lodging, he's a hot fucking dude. And I was like, pulled it off.
I do love that kind of twist, you know, when all of a sudden
his character's name in Gas Food Lodging.
It's
a great name.
Such a strange character name.
It is Dank.
Yeah. I just like my Letterboxd review for it was like the cinema can accomplish miracles, like making a hot Robert Knepper. So,
I mean, it's a great movie. Fairuza Balk, Ione Skye. It's a really good. I understand why it had its moment, and I understand why like people were like buzzy about her as a writer filmmaker. And we talked about this a little bit, Emily, on our episode. But do you remember the movie Grace of My Heart? Does this mean anything to you, Katie?
No.
Leanna Douglas was the lead in it. Scorsese produced it because spoiler, they were dating at the time. And it was about this singer songwriter in I believe the 50s or 60s, and like it had a big budget and it had a big push behind it, and it just didn't do anything. And I feel like that was sort of the moment when Allison Anders was either going to break or not. And
every so often Scorsese like is just like this person is, I'm putting my thumb on the scale for them, and he did that for Allison Anders, and it just didn't break.
I think a lot of it's just Ileana Douglas as a lead in a movie at that time, I mean, or quite frankly ever, unfortunately, just seemed like it wasn't in the cards. But either way, it's a great episode. Gas Food Lodging, Katie, thank you so much for coming on
guys,
and with us.
Thank you. It's just fun to have an excuse to like pick up kind of a cable classic, because we don't have cable anymore, and just like us talking makes me be like, I'm gonna put on A Few Good Men after this. I see the appeal of living in 1992 for a while. Emily is shaking her head at A Few Good Men.
A Few Good Men is a perfectly entertaining movie that I had. It was like the second episode we recorded, and it was just Phil and two other people for like 2.5 hours quoting the movie. It was, I was like, what is happening?
I felt bad. We had Liz Hannah and her husband Brian Milliken on, and the three of us are just such fans of A Few Good Men. And Emily was just like, it's fine, but why are you beating me with all of this dialogue?
Yeah, it's Katie, plug anything you want to plug.
My podcast Fighting in the War Room has been on for over a decade, and I do it every week with other writers and podcasters you might know, David Ehrlich, Matt Patches, and Dave Gonzalez. And I have an Instagram now that is open to the public, and I'm trying to use it. It's Katie Rich Talking. And then I'm Katie Rich on Twitter and Letterboxd, so you can find me those places too.
Thank you so much, Katie.
Thanks, guys. This was absolutely fun. A blast.
We hope that you'll come back and talk movies with us in the future.
Yeah. So wait, you're moving on to what year? Sorry, are we still on the show?
This isn't official yet, so we're gonna keep it hush hush for our listeners. Yes, we will be the podcast will be changing in August. It will be evolving, and we will be announcing said evolution soon.
And so we're talking about the 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
Emily's just really into one. Emily's been sending me, and this is actually true, has been sending me Wikipedia links to silent films like
from the 1890s. Yeah,
from the 1890s.
So they're all about 4 minutes all like long. 5 minutes. Uh huh. I went to one of the summers I was young and in New York and didn't have anything to do. I went to a thing at the Anthology Film Archives that was just the Lumiere brothers, but it was just like an hour and a half of just those, and it really wears on you after a while. I gotta say, there's not a lot to engage with.
There was one, Emily, that was just like something in Greece. I can't remember what it was.
It's like called The Fighting in Greece, and it's just boats firing at each other in Greece.
Sounds great.
Sounds great. Can you? But yeah, 1890s coming soon to podcast like this. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
Well, Katie, we can't wait to talk to you in the future.
Thanks, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.